This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 15th of December 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 232 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
We've got a fantastic show lined up today. We'll be collecting knick-knacks aplenty and discover the wonderful world of antiques. And we might even tell you a few insider tips with Antiques Roadshow expert Mark Allam.
We'll also be speaking to Patrick Grant, the man behind revered Savile Row tailors Norton & Sons, and find out why sewing is suddenly sexy again.
And finally, we'll be joined by two photographers who spent a week living with the homeless, all in a bid to make art a little bit more accessible.
A great show in the works. Plus, Tom Edwards will be here with his weekly news look ahead, and we'll play some music for you too. You're listening to episode 232 of the Monocle Weekly. Here we are then.
So sewing is suddenly sexy. It's not just sexy, it's suddenly sexy.
Suddenly sexy. It's like bang. How is it? Yeah, I'm going to be intrigued as to how this happens.
Yeah, because one minute you were sitting there slowly kind of like patching your jumper, and then suddenly, oh, this is sexy.
I know. I've got a rip in my jeans. I might kind of put a little bit of, a fishnet over it.
I'm looking forward to seeing him cotton. Though. Because this week I went to the Button Queen. I lost the button.
I
lost the button of a cardigan, and there's a shop near us here. It's called the Button Queen.
What are you going to wear when you're sewing the button on? What are you going to wear? Anything sexy?
Ooh, I don't know. Something. I'm going to change for sewing my button on.
Oh, think,
something a bit more casual.
It depends on sort of what button and what. I mean, if you're doing a cardigan, I think you need to sort of counter the sort of the comfy pipe and slippers cardigan type of thing with something. Show a bit of leg, Andrew.
It's hard to feel about being hot and sexy while wearing a cardigan, isn't it?
I think, yeah, to count, you need a silk robe.
That's Send me a picture in cardigan.
It's pretty nice. This is all off the back of Patrick Grant. He's sort of a mate of ours, isn't he? We can be a little bit cheeky about Patrick. He's a good-looking man. He's a handsome man. He could probably make sewing sexy. I want to see. I kind of want to see what he's wearing today. You know, because it's Sunday. Sunday rules.
Yes.
What does a well-dressed man wear on a Sunday?
Normally, he is only attired as a gentleman. But yeah. I did see him the other day in like a kind of one of those kind of like funny flat-foot running shoes.
Yeah, I've been out for a drink with him, and he's basically dressed as a fisherman. So who knows? Who knows which way the wind will blow and how it'll happen?
Yeah, we'll see how sexy he looks as well in with his crocheting and his bag.
Button Queen, of course, a great name. I think is the man that runs it the Button Queen, or is it? Well, do you think he's inherited the title of the shop?
I think he's inherited the title. He was very helpful. He had a lady in there as well.
Did he?
Millions of buttons, and literally he was like, I need to replace this one button. I've been so many other places. He's like, hold on 1 second, I've got what you need. £2, that's what he charged me.
Oh, that's great. And they're proper horn buttons. I mean, they're all very nice. They're all different ones. I snazzed up one of my blue Japanese coat with some new buttons from the Button Queen.
Who knew that we were all beating a path to the Button Queen these days?
I don't know about Patrick Grant. I thought I'd already made sewing sexy way back when I first visited the Button Queen. With all this talk of buttons, we better get Jack Phillips, who's through the glass, to press the button to introduce our next guest. You know who it is. It's Tom Edwards with this week's News Look Ahead.
It's Sunday. It's midday. Live from London, this is the Monocle Weekly. With his look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
We don't often have that introduction for you, Tom. I love that one. It's sort of like I don't know how you describe it, like kind of the organ that would be on a Chris Rea B-side.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's kind of an easy listening.
Yeah, it's kind of like Radio
gentle,
2 in the late 80s.
Yeah, hey. Takes you straight there.
Before we go any further, do you find sewing sexy?
Sewing?
You're trying to say it in a sexy voice, Andrew. Do you find sewing sexy?
I think seamstress maybe working there. Dexterity with the fingers, of course. Is that where you're going with this?
So what says to Tom Edwards is a woman in her rightful place. That's what you're saying.
Well, I wouldn't put it exactly like that, Rob, but I think sewing can be pretty sexy.
We're having a sexy sewing session later on.
Wow.
You're invited.
I think I'll just make my excuses and leave and retreat to a safe distance.
I'm just going
to
reach around you and just do up that button. I say do up that button.
Oh, tight.
Okay. Are we going to have that slightly awkward thing where we go from sort of like a bit too jovial an opening and then you go, yeah, right, let's talk about Palestine.
That, yeah, that is exactly what's going to happen.
Oh, no.
I was going to make some kind of darn it joke.
Let's have it.
Hey.
Yes. That's right.
Okay.
Okay, calm. Change of pace. Tom, what's the first news story today?
Let's talk about transatlantic trade agreements.
Really?
No, I just think this is interesting because in Washington, D.C., from tomorrow, the U.S. and EU get the third round of these transatlantic trade and investment partnership negotiations back on track. You'll remember, of course, that they've been...
I enjoyed the second round.
Well, you see, it was interesting, wasn't it, Andrew? Because I clearly remember talking
who's
to you
on points?
At the time. Well, I would say it's probably like some kind of score draw at the moment.
Ding, ding. Okay.
Because there's quite a lot of dissatisfaction at the time. Remember, Angela Merkel's phone had been eavesdropped upon, and that all came out just around the time they were trying to get this thing off the ground. But there's a lot more hope now that they can actually thrash out a deal, and it would be very significant because we're talking about $30 trillion of output. It's basically half the world's total output between the US and EU.
I can't imagine how big would the suitcase need to be in the cartoon in my head to have $30 trillion in it.
It's sizable. It would probably burst open and the notes would wind up, you know, on the lunar surface, for example. But lots of people say this is actually bad news because it would compromise consumer protection. So it's very interesting. And, you know, can people get a lot of this, the politics, a lot of this background off the agenda and actually talk about the trade? Will they be able to do it? We'll find out in DC this week. Also tomorrow, Bahrain's National Day. I'd like to try and flag up potential hotspots. Obviously, remember back in the summer of this year when they celebrate the sort of Independence Day and we had the sort of Tamarod protest movement. Mm. It galvanised a lot of people in Bahrain to protest against the heavy-handed administration there. And it's interesting to see how they'll mark this National Day, which traditionally was, you know, fireworks and, well, the good kind of fireworks. Interesting to see tomorrow whether it's rather more incendiary.
Are they predicting there could be some trouble?
There could be some problems, I think, just because these Tamarod activists are very effective at mobilising people, particularly at short notice. So if the government tries to present this front that everything is all well and good, they may find a challenge from the streets. One to watch tomorrow, perhaps.
And is there another one to watch? You pause there for special effect.
No, I just like to. That was a pregnant pause.
No, yeah, that was good. I was going to say, I didn't want to ruin the silence.
No.
Okay. Well, somebody has to eventually.
Okay, no, otherwise it's
I'll
terrible.
I'll be here all day. let's lighten the mood, though. Those are both kind of fairly serious. And you know, I like to talk to you about auctions and, you know, works of art, masterpieces.
You do, yeah,
we've got a gentleman coming on from the Antiques Roadshow.
Well, this couldn't be more perfect.
I feel like it's Sunday tea time already, Tom.
What would you say, Rob and Andrew?
Get out your crumpets.
Would you like to... Hold on. What about a Picasso gouache? Could be yours.
A Picasso goulash?
Gouache. For just €100.
What?
Am I mistaken? I don't
hear
you asking. No, it's a million...
That's a very tiny
It's a million-dollar picture. And basically, some person who shall remain anonymous demonstrated their largesse by donating this work to...
I don't like to talk about things like that.
..a charity. Well, I was just trying to sort of imply it, Rob, without getting specifics. But it's being auctioned by Sotheby's in Paris through a sort of tombola system. So you buy your ticket for a humble €100. And obviously, it's massively oversubscribed. They end up raising many millions more, even than the picture is worth, for great causes. So this is being backed by Olivier Picasso, Pablo's grandson. Buy a ticket, he says, and enjoy a double pleasure.
What are the two pleasures?
The thrill of the tombola and the satisfaction of owning an artwork, knowing that your money is supporting wonderful, noble causes. The picture in question is L'Homme au Gibou.
What's a gibou?
Qu'est-ce que c'est gibou?
It's the man in the opera hat.
Oh.
That's got a specific French word. I'm not too ashamed I didn't know that.
Exactly. I don't think it's bad. By all accounts, according
to I'm going to try. This is the thing. We've got to go for our next guest. But I'm going to try and get that word into the rest of the show. Yeah.
We know another gibou word as well, don't we? A Hungarian word.
Of course. Giboudash.
Giboudash. Do you know what giboudash means?
I don't, but by the way you're saying it,
it's quite good.
It's
not a sewing term. Right. What happened?
It's almost is.
Yes.
This all ties together beautifully.
So poor Rob's in the dark here, wondering what's going on. Tommy, who is our Hungarian colleague, the other day he was struck by pins and needles. He jumped up, he grabbed his leg, and he went, "Oh, giboudash."
And pins and needles.
Yeah, pins and needles.
Ah, that's a great word. Yeah. I love that. My friend Pony's Hungarian, and but the only word of Hungarian I really know is rakott krumpli, which is a delicious dish of sort of eggs and beetroot and potatoes and strangeness.
I imagine if you overeat your racket crumbly, you'd probably suffer from jibberdash in the aftermath.
You could possibly do. Nice, we've welded those two things together. But Patrick Grant's appeared.
Yeah, the man who makes...
The man who's making sewing sexy. Yeah. Look at him, yeah. There he is. He's got a bomber. He's doing some sort of thrusting motion behind the glass. Tom Edwards, thank you very much for your news look ahead. I can't wait for the news.
Was it seamless?
It was seamless.
Oh.
And welcome back to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. Now it's time for us to turn our attention not to the high street, but to the far more refined Savile Row. Norton & Sons is one of the oldest bespoke tailors, operating since 1821. But after the company was finding it on difficult times, it was looking for a new owner, and it turned to a rather unlikely source.
Patrick helped to revive the struggling business, and today is helping to bring Savile Row to the masses. That's not true, is it? You don't like the masses?
No, we have...
he's helping to bring Savile Row to
massive,
the few.
Massive, perhaps, okay. But maybe not the masses.
He's going as far as trying to make the art of sewing sexy again. As if it wasn't ever sexy in the first place. I'm delighted to say we're joined by Patrick here in the studio. Patrick, we have been talking about sewing getting sexy, suddenly getting sexy. Is it sexy, or is it just kind of...
I'm struggling a little with this notion that sewing should be sexy, but I think all of a sudden making things with one's hands is certainly much more appealing and inverted commas sexier than it used to be. I think we're, as a nation, sort of returning generally to the idea that actually going to work and not sitting typing onto a computer and staring at a screen is a good idea. You know, going to work where one's hands and one's physical energy is employed in doing something real, I think all of a sudden is feeling much sexier than it used to be.
And just quickly tell the listeners about your TV show, because this is the kind of launching point for this.
Well, about a year and a half, almost 2 years ago, a commissioning editor from the BBC called Emma Willis decided that it would be a good idea to commission a show about sewing. And basically most of the BBC laughed her out of court, but she stuck with it and produced a show that is effectively as a competition for amateur sewers. The idea is to find Britain's best amateur sewer. It's called The Great British Sewing Bee. And it was a surprise hit. You know, we routinely got 2.5 to 3 million viewers for a show effectively where, you know, people are making clothes on telly, and it worked.
I like that. I think they should turn them off at the end. That'd be my tip. It'd be like a ITV2 show, a BBC yes. 2 or a BBC 3 show. That's what yes. it would
be. I'm a sewer, get my kit off now.
Exactly. There you go. Right. So like, unpick it, the yes. seams.
That could be the extra version of
that's, it. That's all right, isn't it? Yeah. I originally, when I was reading through this, what was going to be in the script today, I misread it and I thought it was Patrick Grant's making sewing sexy. I was like, there's a man. I didn't realise he had such a passion yes. for litigation.
For tort, yes.
And the show is one of those things where it's kind of competition. It's kind of cozy TV, but presumably the idea is that you learn something from watching it as well.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's two things. It's a celebration of a craft which has been undervalued for a long time, but it's also a celebration of individual people who are genuinely massively passionate about their hobby. And I think we enjoy sort of slipping into the world of nice, ordinary folk being brilliant at something and really enjoying it. And the show treats everybody with great respect in exactly the same way as The Great British Bake Off, which is its sort of older sibling, does, and has attracted a massive audience for, you know, for baking, which we probably wouldn't have thought possible again a decade ago. But it is. It's great people doing something that they love and us just kind of standing by and watching.
And there's obviously been some discussion of why it's been successful. Some people have kind of pointed out this is a time of, you know, austerity, supposedly, in some quarters, and, you know, that people like the idea of a bit of thriftiness being shown on our television screens. They feel a bit uncomfortable with just, you know, the gratuitous kind of, you know, lavishness of some other kind of parts of TV world. Do you think that is true?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are lots of things that make it successful. I think generally we as a nation are enjoying the idea of not being so throwaway about the things we buy. And so the two parts, I mean, making your own clothes might not be for everyone, but it is actually for an increasingly large audience and growing audience. But part of it is also, you know, just, you know, to learn how to sew a button back on or just repair a little tear or whatever it might be and make the things that we buy last a good deal longer. And I think nobody can find fault in that as an idea. And I think that's why, you know, partly why it's working so well.
And there's an idea, presumably, of Savile Row kind of sort of it's not a million miles away from that, and investing in a good suit, and then it lasts the distance, and it's repairable, and it's alterable, and all the rest of it.
It's all part of that same continuum. You know, we have spent a long time, probably the best part of two decades, learning how and getting used to the idea of buying something inexpensive and chucking it away, which all of a sudden we realise is not only, you know, it's just an awful thing to do. You just, you know, it's terrible. It's wasteful. It's, you know, it's gratuitous and it's not nice. And we're all of a sudden, you know, why are we doing this? And can't we, isn't there a better way? And this is part of that sort of emergence again, you know, part of the, you know, we're going back to trying to find ways to make things in this country generally. And manufacturing is back on the agenda for Britain. And this is just a small part of starting a process that re-educates people to the fact that, you know, we can make things really well, but we need to be very good at it to make it worth doing.
No, I was just going to jump in about Savile Row. You never hear a Savile Row tailor saying, oh, times are great. But I wondered if actually times weren't so bad at the moment. We're looking at London, the property market, the cash coming through the city, the people desiring to be Londoners, whether they're actually from, you know, Kazakhstan or from China or from Singapore. Are some of those people knocking at the doors of the Savile Row tailors?
They are, and in increasing numbers. I mean, I think, you know, the genuine bespoke tailors on the street, those that have stuck with the traditional craft, albeit in a more relevant looking guise, I think are seeing themselves with order books that are ever increasing. I mean, our own, I can only speak with great knowledge of my own business, but we've seen a massive uptick in business. And some of that are new residents to London with money from elsewhere, former Soviet countries, Asia, South America. You know, it's not just the traditional kind of Western European and Eastern American market.
And do people, when they come in, maybe new customers especially, want to sort of see behind the scenes? Because your shop's got obviously a big, a smallish front. I mean, it's like a nice and frontage, and it's got a big back, and that's the most fascinating bit, isn't it?
I think almost all of our customers are fascinated with the idea that actually the clothes are made on the premises, and that they can meet and have a conversation with the person that is actually making the clothes for them. I mean, obviously the cutter is very intimately involved with the customer in the creation of the suit, but the actual tailors are back there too. And I think they all of our customers enjoy, even if they don't want to go and chat to them, the fact that they can see them sewing. You know, again, I think we've gone through a long period where luxury brands have increasingly sort of divorced themselves from their product. They've just become very expensive and very slick marketing operations, and there aren't very many who retain their own manufacturing. And I think businesses that do make will fare better than those that devolve themselves, you know, from all of that manufacture, from the materials, from the making, and often now from the design of their own products. You know, I think we will get bored of, you know, that very slick marketing, and we will want to go back to businesses that have a root in actually making something and know how to do it.
I wanted to ask you about the business machinations down your street as well, because I went to a store opening the other day, and I believe it's kind of owned by Tommy Hilfiger and kind of owned by a hedge fund and kind of owned by a huge chain of people behind what looks like a very, you know, classic old business. And is that the case for many of those enterprises down Savile Row now, that actually they've just got so big that they are owned by hedge funds and by people who are money men, really?
There has been a big change. I've been on Savile Row now 8 years, and in that time, I think probably four or five of the bigger houses have swapped hands. A couple have swapped hands a couple of times. And, you know, there is a very large Chinese contract manufacturing business, which, you know, has generated a lot of additional cash and has bought Geese and Hawks, Kilgour, Hardy Amies, and has restarted another old brand that I don't know where they found it, but that's now in a store at number two. And a big hedge fund has now bought Huntsman, and there are changes afoot in the ownership of these businesses. And I think it's very interesting to see how the actual craftspeople react to those changes. For some odd reason, there's been a rumor circulating around Savile Row that Norton's has been acquired by the Chinese, which isn't true. But our tailors, you know, got drunk last night at one of the guys' retirement dues and sort of implored me not to sell. You know, please, you know, we love it here and we love this workshop and we don't want it to change. And I think those new owners, you know, have to treat the craftspeople and the workshops with enormous respect, and sometimes they don't. And it is creating movements. Lots of, you know, younger tailors are kind of voting with their feet and changing workshops. And I think the picture will only continue to evolve, because actually, you know, Savile Row really does need to up its game in terms of its how it sells to the new world, but it needs to retain its craftspeople or it will lose its, you know, its.
Sorry to jump in again, but what's interesting, I guess, is you don't want the brand then to become, you know, them to do kind of a cheaper line out of Shenzhen.
And well, it's already happening with some. You know, there are, I mean, I won't say who, but, you know, there are, one of our neighbours already has a couple of hundred stores in China, you know, is effectively a tiny little bespoke business, which is a front for an enormous ready-to-wear business. And I think there is a danger in that, because if you have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of suits bearing the name Savile Row, and they have, you know, literally no association with the street at all, then it can't help, I think, but in the long term devalue the brand. And, you know, the Savile Row brand is important to those of us that work there because it in the past stood for exceptional quality.
Is there a thing like a wine label where it has to come from a certain place? I mean, how much Savile Row does it have to be in the Savile Row suit?
Well, the truth is actually none. You know, Scotch whisky has to be made in Scotland. Mm. But, you know, you can open a store on Savile Row, call your suit a Savile Row suit. There is no protection of that sort. And you know, we got into it. The Savile Row Bespoke Association got into a big battle to try and have some sort of protection. And Savile Row Bespoke suits, now, you know, we have this accreditation and there is a label, the Savile Row Bespoke Association label, which you will find on genuine bespoke suits. But it doesn't change the fact that any Tom, Dick and Harry can rent a, you know, can lease a shop.
Is that the name of that new brand on?
but it will be coming soon, off Savile Row. But the point is, you can do it. You don't, you know, it's not like champagne where it's absolutely carefully controlled. And I think it probably ought to be, and I don't know quite. It's an expensive battle. I mean, the Scotch whisky Association have got a lot of money. They're big and they can employ expensive lawyers. The Savile Row Bespoke Tailors are a small bunch. And those with money are now the ones that have everything to gain by selling lots of ready-made suits. So it's an interesting position for everyone.
We're almost back to making sewing sexy.
Can I have just like two words? Next year, 2014, single-breasted, double-breasted?
Both. In equal measure. I'm not going to say one or the other. I will sell half as many suits.
Loud or quiet?
Quiet.
Oh, good.
That was good. Loud or quiet? Quiet. Very nice radio from Patrick Grant. Thank you so much for coming in. Patrick Grant of Norton & Sons and of the great British
Sewing Bee.
Sewing Bee. I wanted to say Spelling Bee.
This Sunday night.
Oh, tonight?
Yes, tonight. Sunday evening, 7:40 BBC Two.
Nice. Mm. Patrick, thank you so much.
You are very
us.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Time for a track now. This is new from Of Montreal. It's Triumph of Disintegration.
The last 10 days have been a mother. I don't know if I'd survive.
That was new from Of Montreal. It's called Triumph of Disintegration.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time, it was seen with disdain, but over the years, that culture had gotten so popular, it's iconic now.
If you're serving decent food in East London, I don't think you've got any problem getting custom in. And I worked in the West End for years, you know. I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu. Every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
There's a saying in Mexico, for everything bad, mezcal. For everything good, the same. Monocle Films visits Oaxaca to meet the people injecting new life in an ancient beverage, taking mezcal from small Mexican villages to the world's capital.
Most mezcals are produced by families in their villages, in small batches using traditional methods handed down through generations. Mezcal is traditionally a farmer's drink, a working class spirit, but it's also one steeped in folklore and a particularly Mexican sense of magic and mysticism.
Liquid Courage, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. You may not want to admit it, but I think it's safe to say that all of us have spent at least a couple of minutes glued to the TV programme Antiques Roadshow. The show has people lining up for hours, all in the hopes of cashing in and maybe learning something. Armed with their most cherished family heirlooms, they hope that the antiques experts will say ka-ching and give them news that their ratty old tea set is actually worth tens of thousands of pounds. Unfortunately, it's usually the opposite.
Well, one of those experts on Antiques Roadshow is Mark Allam, and he's put years of experience into a new book titled The Antiques Magpie. The book will bring together insider tips on how to discover fakes and forgeries, and even why a Chinese five-clawed dragon, rather than four, can make a porcelain vase worth millions. Well, joining us in the studio now is Mark. Welcome to the programme. A very fine book here. It's kind of lots of short chapters, lots of interesting insights to the things that you've discovered along the way. What's your ambition to try and make us all better antiques hunters?
I suppose so, in a certain sort of way. To be frank, it's really a book about me in many respects.
And why not?
Yeah, I know. It sounds a bit self-promoting, doesn't it? But actually,
you're the magpie, not the antique.
Absolutely. Icon, the publishers, actually, I think for once gave me, and this is not something publishers often do, gave me a total free hand to write what I wanted to, essentially. Nice. And so I was able to put down a lot of anecdotal things, a lot of great stories, and a lot of things that really, really interested me. So it might sound a bit selfish. I didn't really think about the people I was writing it for so much. It was just a really big eclectic collection of kind of my thoughts and kind of what goes on in my head, really.
And how much of the anecdotal stuff in the book is sort of fodder from that hugely successful BBC TV show, The Antiques Roadshow? I mean, because it's sort of halfway about the antiques and halfway about the human story behind them, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, you kind of jested about the idea of, you know, people cashing in and wanting to have things that were valuable kind of looked at on the show. But in fact, actually, to be frank, we find that it's more about the story than the value a lot of the time. You know, first off, it's great to have a valuable item put in front of you, but you really want to know that there's something behind that. And the person you're talking to essentially, you know, can get a grip of that as well. So, you know, I'm as likely to film something that's worth £10 if it's got a really great story, but obviously I'm very happy to see someone's eyes light up if it's worth £10,000.
Yeah. And just looking through the various sections, I like to learn the word cacophily, is that right?
Cacophily?
Yes, the collecting of keys.
Oh, is it? I thought it was a small town in Wales.
Yeah. Well, they make a nice cheese. Is that the mispronunciation of that word?
Do you know, I can't even remember.
Well, I'm going to tell you.
There's a great array of...
Let's go to page 106. Cacophily, you see? And it says that the most expensive key, the Titanic... That was a key with a story. £90,000.
Yeah, that's
key.
A key, wow, with a real story, because the fact that it was left on shore could have been the difference between whether the Titanic hit the iceberg or not, because that was the key to the binocular cabinet in the crow's nest.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And the gentleman whose pocket it was in didn't go on board. There was a change of roster, and the key never made it to the crow's nest. So, you know, these are the kind of objects that really in themselves are just absolutely worthless, but their associations are...
They're sort of worthless but priceless.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a strange thing, isn't it? There's obviously, I wonder how many of the things in the book are associated with notoriety rather than simply value, because it's a sort of artistic question, isn't it? It can be a paint and it's canvas, but it can be tenner or it can be £1 million.
Well, absolutely, you know, and there are many kind of things, you know, that all art is useless is a great kind of until basically all of a sudden it's by somebody or it has an association that makes it worthwhile, and a lot of objects are really very much like that. You have to read into them, so it's very it's very interesting the way people say, well, I could daub a picture like that, you know, that must have taken 10 minutes to do, but they don't appreciate the background of that picture, and that's what's often important.
And tell me, one of the things that scares people off buying antiques is the feeling that they could be easily hoodwinked, that there are so many fakes and forgeries out there, and you do have a whole kind of section on everything from, you know, mirrors that had like the inscriptions scrawled on the back by somebody to try and make them appear to come from a stately home, to as you were saying, that, you know, porcelain vases and things that have been faked because, you know, there's a market for them in China.
It's an absolute minefield, it really is, but it's a problem that's as old as collecting itself. You know, I think I mentioned in the book that Pliny moaned as he walked around the markets of Rome that you know, he moaned about everything from fake wine to fake bronzes. And it's, you know, frankly, since people have collected or wanted the best, there's always been someone out there who's been willing to fake or forge it. So in my occupation, I'm used every day to divining those things that are put on the market to try and fool people. But quite frankly, a lot of them are very poor. So for the layman who's not used to dealing with those kind of objects, they can take you in initially. But quite frankly, a lot of them are just poor copies and reproductions rather than fakes. So it's trying to define what is a fake, what is a reproduction, and just addressing that. But there's not a day goes by that I don't have to deal with it.
And Mark, your background is as an antiques dealer, and is that how you came to the show?
No, I basically started life as an auctioneer. In fact, actually, I was just a strange kid. I collected from a young
he
age.
He says.
I collected from a young age. And in fact, actually, believe it or not, I trained as a sound engineer and I wanted to make it in the music business. Uh-huh. But I was so interested in antiques that my career took a slightly different direction. And, you know, I never looked back. I moved into the auctioneering business and, you know, really seriously enjoyed it.
That's an amazing set. Like, I don't know where you did that, but the regional auctioneering scene is fascinating, isn't it? That's the one. I always used to trail around with my parents to various ones in Sussex, and they're always like the most amazing places. They're presumably the places where you can only really unearth a gem, actually, something that's undiscovered, possibly, right?
Well, it's I live in Wiltshire, and the regional auction houses around me are a great source of interest. And I'm not saying that you buy bargain after bargain. You don't. Sometimes things are very poorly catalogued. Sometimes things are lying in boxes. But I'm not joking, someone nearly always spots them. So if you spot it, you can bet your life someone else is generally going to spot it as well. And there's many times I've seen something priced at £30 to £40 and I've underbid it to £1,500 and still not got it.
Now tell me the truth, when those people come on the Antiques Roadshow and they say, how did you get that?
Well, that presumes that all the other things you've said have been lies.
No, this is a test, because I often wonder when I'm watching the show, they say, where'd you get that lovely locket from? And they say, well, my grandmother used to work in a stately home and she was given to it by the lady of the house. And you think, really? Or did you have sticky fingers?
Well, I think a lot of those stories are true. But the trouble is a lot of myths and stories abound about objects as well. And people often get it wrong. Hearsay stories that pass along family lines. You know, people don't often appreciate how long a generation is. To us, really, a generation is 30 years. But they think that if their grandmother bought it, and she was 90 when she died, that it must be 90 years old. But what they don't understand is that she could have only bought it 10 years ago. And this is a little bit of an argument you often have with people. So it's a strange one. Yeah. Provenance, it's everything.
Probably that's one of the names of your chapters. One of the keys to a book like this is, I presume, lots of kind of quick dips into it. And the chapter headings are intriguing and presumably there to pull you in. I like Gnome Alone. I like swordplay. My favourite is Napoleon's penis.
Yeah, that seems to be everybody's favourite, that one.
Do tell.
I have to say, actually, when I'm kind of out and about talking about my book, of course, I do use Napoleon's penis.
Have you got that one flagged up? I probably have.
It's interesting. You know, collectors often want a bit of somebody famous.
It's a relic, isn't it?
Exactly. It can be an object associated with them, or it can be, in this case, part of them. We all know about, you know, locks of hair and things like that. It just so happens that when Napoleon died and the autopsy was done on Napoleon, that rather more of him was taken away than you might have anticipated, including his penis. And that now resides in a private collection in America. Who knows what it's worth, maybe £100,000 or whatever, but it's actually quite a fascinating idea. In fact, actually, I didn't mention it in this book, but Rasputin's penis is actually also in a jar in Russia.
What a museum that is.
Yeah.
I love that. I don't want to do a boner part joke, so I'm not going to do it.
Now, I also like the Kellogg story, which is actually You point out that actually very recently Kellogg's was giving away in cereal little bits of meteorites, and the collector's cards are worth like £500 now.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, even when those bits of meteorite were coming out in those boxes of Kellogg's, I was thinking, oh, my God, I wouldn't mind this collection. You know, you've got some real meteorite here. And in fact, those shavings are the shavings of scientific research. And some bright spark thought, yeah, we can collect these all up, mount them on cards and put them in cereal packets. And of course, they've become a real collectible. You can go on eBay and see sets of them for several hundred pounds. So, you know, you can anticipate sometimes what's a good object, what's an interesting object. But certainly, you know, that to me, I'd love anything associated with meteorites and tektites and things like that. So that was an instant kind of no-brainer to me. Yes, collect them.
Should we do the job on Mark's book?
Yes.
I can see this is a new book. I can see that, and you can see the maker's name. It's right on the front there. It's by Mark Allam. It's called The Antiques Magpie. This is going to be very popular, probably in 2014, late 2013. And I'd value it about £12.99.
I'd say you were pretty well spot on. of course, a signed version is probably going to be worth a little bit more. Probably about £13.99. I would imagine.
Mark Allam, The Antiques Magpie. Himself. Thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Weekend Edition is the perfect way to wind down from your working week and prepare for the days ahead. Every Saturday and Sunday, we bring you a mix of new music, global front pages, insightful interviews, and lively guests.
He just gets better and better. He's really terribly good. And so it's absolutely aggravating and brilliant, of course.
There's also the usual eclectic mix of Monocle 24 programming, a look back at a few broadcasting highlights, and a preview of some of the shows to come.
This is a film that took 3 years to make. We traveled to 10 countries. There's over 20 different stories in the film about people interacting in one way or another. The scope of it is pretty massive.
That's The Weekend Edition with me, Georgina Godwin. All day Saturday from 8 a.m. and on Sundays from 1600 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Around the world, some countries look beyond military might to exert a more nuanced influence. In our fourth annual Soft Power Survey, we take the pulse of these subtle superpowers and ask if soft can thrive in hard times. Monocle Films spins the globe with a graphic animation featuring the 10 countries that we rank highest this year.
Germany's rise to the top should not come as a surprise. The country is traditionally excellent at pursuing its ideas, values and aims using diplomatic, cultural and economic tools. Germany is, understandably, wary about projecting a dominant image abroad, but by quietly doing the simple things well, it's a country that has become a global power, and the rest of us can feel comfortable with that.
The Soft Parade. 10 countries getting it right. In the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. It's time for us to turn now to the world of art. Artists Johnny Burse and Joe Kennedy both have very strong opinions about the art world, and in much of their work have tried to stress the importance of substance and inclusiveness. They've curated a show called Utopia, featuring different artists' visions of just that.
The exhibition also aims to raise awareness about homelessness, particularly during the holiday season. Utopia will launch later this week. And I'm very happy to say we're joined here in the studio now by Johnny Burt and Joe Kennedy. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, we just want to unpick a little bit about what the show is about and what exactly you've been doing. Perhaps, Joe, you'd like to kind of lead off and explain what the show is about.
Sure, yeah. So Utopia is, for us, it's kind of a metaphor for a belief in a better world. We're very privileged to be working in the art industry, and we want to kind of use that for good, to make a good change, good social change. So Utopia is basically our vision of a better world, and we want to try and make a difference, particularly for the guys on the street in the run-up to Christmas.
I like the idea of that. I mean, what were their ideas? Were they how easy is it to sort of approach people and sort of go, what's your idea of Utopia when your worlds seem to be so different?
Yeah, it wasn't easy because we had to kind of prepare how we were going to approach, and we just had to kind of be very
careful as well, because it's always crossing that line. You don't want to be exploitative. But we were just very honest and upfront, and we were just, you know, because what we want to do is ultimately tell their story. As a gallery, we like to class ourselves as being quite an ethical gallery in the sense that we want to do more than just showcase art. We want to create a social, cultural change. And so that's, we explained that to him. We were very upfront. And we said we want to, you know, we're all about giving the unheard voice. And we said that's how we approached him, basically.
Presumably one of the points of it is that it's an issue that is often covered on the news, especially in the run-up to Christmas, et cetera, et cetera. No surprises there, but the art can shine a different sort of light onto an issue that simply yet another news story can't.
Exactly. Well. And the hook for us was always, you know, art, as Joe said, art normally caters to the privileged, and we want to help the unprivileged through art. And we do think that's quite a unique medium we're doing for this exhibition, you know, raising awareness. It's been such a collaborative thing. All our artists are so on board with it. They've all been delighted to help out and make their contribution. So it's a really nice kind of atmosphere.
So Joe, take us through the front door. We come to the exhibition. What kinds of representations of utopia are there, and what kind of different work has been done by the different artists?
So we've asked them to kind of interpret what utopia might mean for them. So that can range from anything to being quite dark and mysterious to being really kind of bright, powerful, hopeful kind of representations of that concept. We're transforming the gallery into a kind of a Garden of Eden style paradise set. So we've got set designers coming in. So we're sort of transforming the whole space. So we want it to be more kind of a spectacle than just a traditional kind of art exhibition. Mm-hmm. So we're really, really excited about it. Like Johnny said, you know, all the artists are really, really excited about it, really happy to contribute.
And these are all original, these are all commissions for the show. They're all specific to, specific necessarily, but certainly commissioned for the show.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's going to be really interesting to see, we're getting work in delivered this week. It's going to be really interesting to see kind of what their interpretations of that concept is, because at the end of the day, utopia means something different for everybody. And that's something that we wanted to explore. You know, for some people, it means something completely different to somebody else. But at the same time, it's a concept that resonates with everyone. You know, everyone has a vision of a better place.
It's not starlets floating naked in champagne. That's another Costello lyric. I'm just going to say that. That just popped into my head. Yeah. I just want to give
Like you say, everyone has a different...
I just want to give it some context.
Yeah.
And it'd be nice to know how involved you are with the artists. I mean, obviously, I guess you did studio visits and you've talked to them about how it's going to be. Yeah. But still, when you open the crates, when the van's back in and offload the art for you guys to hang... That dreaded word for you guys, hanging the show. That's the exciting point, isn't it? The proof of the pudding's in that, isn't it?
Curating is so exciting. It's quite new because we're artists ourselves and we're on the other side of the fence now. And curating is such a big part, you know, because you can have an amazing piece of work, but if it doesn't fit with the theme or what we're trying to say with the show, then, you know, we have to be very careful. But, you know, I mean, for our launch, we rotated the show like, what, 4 or 5 times? Mm. Just to get it absolutely pitch perfect, you know. So it is hugely exciting, and we're in the sort of beginning stages of that now.
It's certainly our favourite part of putting on a show is the curating, because we're so kind of, we're such perfectionists. If something's slightly out of place, we'll have to change the whole thing. Mm. But it is the most exciting part, getting those final touches done.
And can I ask you both? You're both obviously reasonably young, and this is a world of galleries that, you know, tends to be dominated by people a little bit older than you. Mm-hmm. When you go knocking on artists' doors and you say, look, you know, we want your contribution, we want you to hand over potentially stuff that's worth several thousand pounds to us, you don't know us. How does that, in those first stages of setting up as gallerists, and, you know, as you said, you're artists yourselves as well, how has that process been?
I think it's been exciting because initially we were worried. We were like, ultimately, we're new. Like, no one knows about us. How are we going to do this? But I think we were just very confident in how we created our branding, who we were, our identity. And I think people just gravitated to that really quickly. And so it got to the stage, you know, after the launch where artists were approaching us, you know, and saying, I want to. And well-known, you know, artists from all over the world. You know, we're shipping stuff in for this show, like from Canada, LA. So it did take off. Fortunately, like, we've both got links in the art world through artists that we've already worked with, you know, shows that we've been involved with prior to launching this gallery. So we have used those, but we have had a lot of work go into sort of establishing those connections, forging those friendships, making the artists feel comfortable, you know. So it's been a lot of hard work, but we feel now that we're sort of starting to sort of establish ourselves as the artists can feel comfortable with us. And
your gallery, the unit, is out in Turnham Green, West London. Some listeners might know it. They're getting the Piccadilly line to Heathrow Airport. It's on that. It's that neck of the woods. It's a nice part of the world. Yeah. It's not gallery land, is it? Is having such an experiential sort of site-specific show, important to get people there.
Mm. 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 It's nice to be able to, I mean, especially based in West London, there's a few galleries in West London, but a lot of that demographic, the people who live in West London, to get involved in really kind of original, progressive, contemporary art, they have to go kind of east. And, you know, you go to Brick Lane, you go to Shoreditch, Hoxton, it's kind of teaming with
you've got artists like Pure Evil, you've got Pure Evil and people in
exactly.
here.
Exactly. Sort of and it's really
East
bringing
London
it,
stalwarts.
Yeah. And it's bringing it to a new kind of area and a new demographic of people. And they really want to engage with that kind of art, but they've never really had that kind of channel in West London where they can get it. I mean, there's a few galleries there, but it's been really nice for us to be able to kind of bring that to a kind of a different part of London and showcase it there.
And tell me, your shelter's a very successful organisation of what it does, and you know, it's it knows what it wants to do, and it knows how it wants to present itself. When it engages with something that's perhaps a little bit, you know, more unleashed, like the art world, did they say to you, okay, here's 10 things you can't do, and here's 5 things you have to do, or were they quite willing to kind of let you have some kind of room to manoeuvre?
They have been. They've been really, really supportive of the whole thing, you know, from the word go, and we. Typically, you know, it was quite late in the day when we kind of pitched it to them. The whole idea for the exhibition came out really, really fast and went to Shelter, talked to them instantly. You know, they said they don't really do stuff like this. It's a completely different kind of clientele, completely different kind
they
of
do art
to
stuff
what
before.
They
my
do.
Friend Rick and Dan put on the big the show. At,
yeah, because Dan Baldwin, I think.
Yeah,
a few things.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just us having a chat now.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I like it when the radio gets
you can go down the pub afterwards.
Oh, yeah, that's what you do. Oh, yeah. Actually, also, I went to school with George Morton Clark, I think.
Oh, really?
Did you?
Yeah, yeah.
He's just gone to, where's he gone? He's just gone on
Sri Lanka.
Holiday. Yeah, Sri Lanka. Yeah.
That's nice literally us just talking.
Oh, my God. This is meant to be a radio show, guys.
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay, we're going to have the one random question now.
Yeah.
We had
someone
else on here on the show the other day talking about why redheads are sexy. Oh, you were one of them.
Yes, yes.
He came on and said,
"Well, am I?" Well, you said it.
There was a whole photographic show about it.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry, I thought you. Okay, I thought.
No, but it's actually just one serious question. Actually, following that, we had we did have a kind of entertaining time with him. But it literally that following week, I saw a 14-year-old kid had kind of jumped to his death over this very issue. Is you know, being serious for a moment, is that why again you wanted to get involved in something that had a kind of charity connection?
But maybe subconsciously. I mean,
you just thought it'd be nice to have some pictures of yourself, didn't you?
Yeah. I think it's very nice because obviously Red Hot and Utopia are coinciding with each other within 2 days of each other. You know, the private views, Red Hot is the day before, Utopia is the day after. But I mean, really, Utopia, we wanted to do this exhibition because at Christmas time, you know, the idea of togetherness, family is so acute in our consciousness, you know, and for that reason, we thought that it would be a really nice thing to do, you know, just quite simply an extension of who we are as a gallery, and we're hoping it's going to be an amazing
and
show.
And there he is drawing a veil over his other show.
And that's going to be a great show as well.
The show is Utopia. It's on at the Unit Gallery in Turnham Green. It runs from the 18th to the 31st of December, and the chaps behind it are Johnny Burt and Joe Kennedy. Thank you both for joining us on
thank
the
you
thanks very much sure. for having us.
Well, I enjoyed myself there.
You're going to take
sorry, that was just about something that was happening off mic. Anyway, wasn't much of a show, was it?
I saw you doing a bit of sewing in the corner.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder what you're up to.
Hoo-ha. That was just the way I was standing. So my back to you. That's what my arms are. That was knitting.
It was a bonkers show. It was good. We rattled through that.
I think we made sewing sexy.
Yes.
We learned something about Napoleon's penis.
Yes. And Rasputin's.
And Rasputin's. What a great museum. We've got 2 exhibits.
Yes.
Angry men's cocks.
Yes. And we also managed to talk about redheads, homelessness, and the art of key collecting.
Basically, there's no more. How many more things can we tick off?
I think that's enough.
And we've been invited around for scotch at Patrick's house. That's all right, isn't it?
Yeah, and also Tom Edwards did a good job, didn't he?
Didn't Tom Edwards. I think Tom, when he comes on to that specific theme tune, it softens him.
Yes.
And he feels less, like it's easier for him to live up to. Do you know what I mean? It's a bit more chilled out. You can just walk in and go, hi, cats.
Well, I have asked the gents to make some new ones for 2014. So yeah. If you're called Tom Edwards, maybe you can help us make a new sting for him. We're co-opting all Tom Edwards around the world to give Tom a good run for his money.
That's lovely. We should do one of those portraits made up of just different faces of Tom Edwards, all counting to our Tom Edwards. So much Edwards love, isn't there?
Yes, we all love the Edwards.
Anyway, the Tedwards. That's it. It was number 232, Andrew, wasn't it, of the Monocle Weekly. We should thank our producer, Phil Hahn, for sorting everyone out. And Jack Phillips was our studio manager, the man with the buttons and the levers. He's making, I don't know what he's doing. He's making a pose like Eros behind the glass as we talk about him. We'll be back again at the same time next week. But for now, for me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.